preparation was what I brought from opera, because I did feel like my strengths are working with actors, and now I'm working with actors and singers. And luckily I had a conductor working with me who could do the musical side, but the preparation for an opera is huge, you know, in terms of how you're actually going to set it up on stage. And so I thought, well, the film is only going to be harder than doing an opera, because it's something I don't know on a first film. So I prepared like crazy for this film.
This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. Director William Oldroyd discussing his adaptation of the Russian novella Lady Macbeth. We'll hear more from him and the film's star Florence Pugh today on The Cinema Show. Also ahead.
I think that's why we're so obsessed with this case, is we can all kind of connect to it in some way.
We'll talk to director Kitty Green about her documentary Casting JonBenet, which turns the focus of the notorious murder away from the unsolved case and onto the public obsession. Plus,
it's something so difficult to do, and I found that if you forget more what you're doing, you know, and try not to be so self-conscious about things that are so normal.
50 years after Valley of the Dolls, we'll look back at the film and the lingering impact of Sharon Tate's death on America's motion picture industry. That's all to come on The Cinema Show on Monocle 24.
Our film is taken from the Russian novella called Lady Macbeth of Mytensk by Nikolai Leskov, which was written in 1865. There was a famous opera which was made from that source material. The music was by Shostakovich. And we know of one other film by Andrzej Wajda, which is a Polish film called Lady Macbeth of Siberia, or The Siberian Lady Macbeth, which I think was made in the 1980s, black and white. But what was interesting for us is that actually it felt like an undiscovered classic.
At first glance, you might think that the protagonist of William Oldroyd's new film, Lady Macbeth, is a scorned lover rejected from a Shakespearean story. But the film's central character, as played by Florence Pugh, inhabits a world all her own.
And we felt that people coming to see it would be compelled by this central character of Catherine, who we really love. She's very, very interesting. You don't know quite where you sit in terms of how you feel for her.
This might be rural England in the 19th century, but in many ways, Catherine is a woman with a thoroughly modern state of mind. The gripping story of Lady Macbeth finds her sold into a marriage to a middle-aged man. What transpires is a chillingly twisted take on the Victorian noir.
You know I shan't be parted from your life, Sebastian. Through hell and high water, I will follow you. To the cross, to the prison, to the grave, to the sky.
Director William Oldroyd's adaptation of Nikolai Leskov's novella has attracted glowing reviews. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco sat down with William Oldroyd and the film star Florence Pugh. This is actually William's first feature film, and it's the first time Florence has been cast in a lead role as well. Fernando started by asking Florence about her approach to the complex character of Catherine.
So Catherine starts the film as a child, and I believe she ends the film as a woman, and we watch her grow. I think for me, Catherine is put in certain situations and she reacts to them. I don't think she's evil or cold or mean. I just think she's dealing with what she's been given. And I'm a full supporter of her throughout the entire film. And I've always been a supporter of her.
She almost has some kind of, can you say it's a feminist film perhaps?
Well, this is the thing that we've been finding a little bit tricky at the moment, is because we used to believe that it was, but up until recently, obviously, we've been doing a lot of Q&As and maybe swaying into maybe it isn't.
It's about a young woman who's overcoming adversity, and it's so nice to see a woman on screen playing the protagonist. And it is her story. And in that sense, you know, she is fighting for freedom. That's the whole point of what she does. And that's why we empathise with her. But the question is whether she's doing it for herself, whether she seems to be doing it for a man. And that's where some people have criticised us. But ultimately, I think this man happens to be the person that she's attached all of those emotions to. That desire for freedom, that sort of obsession, that passion, she latches onto him. And so when he starts to break away from her, that's when it becomes difficult. But she's still fighting for herself. So that's where there's a complexity.
And we have to put things in context. I think the film is set, you know, in the late 19th century in rural England as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can't say that it's not a current film as well. Yeah. Even though at times it did feel like that. Because
she feels like a very modern woman in 1865. I think that's why it's so exciting, is because we don't expect her to do any of the things that she does, and the fact that she gets away with it.
William, another thing that I found about the film, as I said, I thought it felt quite modern watching it. And I've been reading quite a few articles. I mean, here in the UK, people are talking about it, about racial diversity in period dramas. Because, of course, in the UK, it's a huge market to have period films. And you do manage this film in a very kind of nonchalant way. You know, here you are, you have two of your main characters. They're mixed race. Did you thought about that? Or was it a pure coincidence, perhaps?
I think what we found was that as we researched the film, we realised that the England that we were making our film, that we were drawing on, was far more diverse than we were led to believe by either other period dramas set in that period or paintings and books from that period. You know, actually, the photographs that we found, and there's a very interesting documentary on BBC called Black and British, showed us that Northumberland and the northeast of England in the mid-19th century was far more diverse than we were led to believe. And should we need historical justification for our casting, we were able to say, well, because of that diversity, we can cast whoever we want, regardless of background, and choose the very best actors for each role. And that's exactly what we tried to do.
And I think you did very well in that sense as well. Florence, coming back to you, you know, the films, of course, I'm not going to reveal the plot, but there are many twists there. It's quite intense. I mean, how was it to live up to the character of Catherine? How was your preparation, or how did you feel after certain scenes?
Obviously, yeah, there is a huge part of Catherine that is very heavy, and she does things that are very difficult to film. And to get into the mindset of that is obviously not normal for me. I don't usually do things like that. But that being said, you know, I don't think that she is in any way mentally ill or psychotic. So she is just playing out what she needs to respond to. So it wasn't like I needed to get into a very confusing headspace for her. And also, that being said, we had a very short shoot, which meant that we were on location, in the same location for the entire shoot, meaning that we could move about a lot and we could film in chronological order. Obviously, that helps a lot for me playing Catherine, because it means that when we finish a day, we're going to be doing the next scene the next day in the same headspace. So it wasn't like I had to jump about that much. I knew exactly where she was at what point in the story. And filming chronologically is actually very rare in a film. So this helped a lot of people hugely.
You mentioned the location of the film. That's another wonderful thing about it. It looks stunning. May I ask, William, where did you film?
We shot in the northeast of England, specifically in the house was in Chesterley Street, which is about 20 minutes south of Newcastle in County Durham. Some of the exteriors we shot in Northumberland National Park and out towards the North Pennines. What we felt was that the book treats isolation in a very interesting way. Catherine is really isolated because it's set in Russia in the middle of the 19th century, and we found that those landscapes in the northeast gave us that so many of them haven't really changed in 150 years if you go out to the wildest parts. And I knew that area from my time spent at university in Durham, so I loved that place and always wanted to make a film there.
Talking about isolation, there's no music in the film as well. Yeah. So was that perhaps for the precise reason about the isolation?
Yes. I mean, I think that what Alice wrote was really stripped back. There was a real austerity of emotion in the film. I think that was, although actually Catherine is very passionate, but the other characters, it's all stripped back. The decor responded to that in a way that was very sort of empty and sparse. And actually we felt that the oral landscape should also be quite sparse. And I wanted to focus specifically on the performances of the actors, so that any emotion that we were to feel should come from performance rather than from sort of emotional signposting through music.
And finally, guys, you know, the film's coming out Friday here in the United Kingdom, but there's also plans for release in the US. So what's next in your schedule?
So it will be coming out July 14th in America, and hopefully we'll be there to support it. right now I haven't got anything to move on from. I've just come off the back of a film shooting, so I'm hopefully going to have a month of silence and then gear up ready for the release in America.
Yeah, we're really happy with our distributor in the States, Roadside Attractions, who saw the film in Toronto, loved the film. Interestingly, they released Winter's Bone, which, as you know, was a breakout performance of Jennifer Lawrence. And when they saw Lady Macbeth, they came to us and said, we've seen Florence, we think we could do something very similar as we did with Winter's Bone, that this really is a sort of stellar performance. So they're excited. They're gearing up for that now. We've been in conversation with them, and I think it's going to be... I think there's a real appetite for period drama with a difference in America. I think that they know that, and so I'll be excited to see how it plays.
William Oldroyd, director of Lady Macbeth and the film's star, Florence Pugh. They were speaking to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Lady Macbeth is out in cinemas right now. Still to come, it has been 50 years since Jacqueline Suzanne's soapy novel, Valley of the Dolls, was adapted into one of the most mocked films in history. We'll look back at the cinematic disaster and its role in one of America's most chilling true crime stories. This is The Cinema Show. Stay tuned. Despite being the world's capital of mainstream film production, Los Angeles occupies a curious place in the minds of filmmakers. While New York has long been the metropolitan muse of filmmakers of a certain pedigree, Martin Scorsese, Noah Baumbach, or of course Woody Allen, movies made in LA are usually more concerned with making us believe we're just about anywhere else. Let's take a look at a few films that have bucked that trend long before La La Land. Throughout the peak of the silent era, Hollywood regularly presented cinemagoers with depictions of itself aimed at promoting the town as a factory of dreams. Just 10 years after the founding of Paramount Pictures, the studio produced a short documentary film titled A Trip to Paramount Town. Audiences of the 1920s were so enamored by the myth and glamour espoused by Hollywood's big studios that they flocked to catch a 20-minute glimpse at what it all might look like behind the scenes. The following year, Paramount expanded on the idea with the feature-length Hollywood, featuring cameo appearances by more than 30 of the studio's contract stars. By the time the 1940s rolled around, some of Hollywood's sheen was beginning to rub off. The burgeoning film noir genre flipped perceptions of the Dream Factory on its head, and with its morally ambiguous protagonists and tales of doomed beauties, presented audiences with a much darker version of the city. The golden age of noir ended sometime during the 1950s, but not before Billy Wilder put a lid on Hollywood's obsession with itself, with his ultimate depiction of egotism gone mad, Sunset Boulevard.
Oh, wake up, Norma. You'd be killing yourself to an empty house. The audience left 20 years ago. Now face it.
That's a lie. They still want me.
No, they don't.
The end of the studio system brought about a whole new crop of Hollywood filmmakers in the 1970s, many of them ready to tear down the old establishment. In 1974, director Mark Robson teamed with an all-star cast to, quite literally, tear the city apart with the disaster epic Earthquake. The 80s and 90s brought about a crop of LA-centric comedies, 9 to 5, Beverly Hills Cop, Ruthless People, and the wonderfully bizarre romance between a department store mannequin and a lonely artist with 1987's Mannequin. Movie subscribers here in the United Kingdom can catch the absorbing 2002 drama Laurel Canyon, starring Frances McDormand as an undisciplined music producer who clashes with her son, played by Christian Bale, during a visit to her lush Los Angeles home. Sample a month of movies for free right now. Head over to mubi.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. 50 years ago, a big screen adaptation of 1966's best-selling novel was released to theatres. Jacqueline Suzanne's novel, Valley of the Dolls, has sold more than 30 million copies, making it one of the best-selling books ever. But director Mark Robson's cinematic adaptation captured the world's attention for entirely different reasons. Valley of the Dolls centres around three young women attempting to navigate their way through the murky world of show business. After convincing the boss of a talent agency to try her out as a secretary, young Anne is horrified by her first encounter with the so-called glitz and glamour. Theatre legend Helen Lawson, played by Susan Heywood, is growing more and more bitter and fearful as her once lucrative career slowly nears its end. When her insecurities result in the axing of a talented young starlet named Neely O'Hara, played with ferocious anger by Patty Duke, Anne and her boss combine forces to launch Neely as Hollywood's next big name.
Don't worry, sweetheart. If it flops, I can always get you a job as understudy for my grandmother.
Thanks. I've already turned down the part you're playing.
Bull. Merrick's not that crazy.
You should know, honey. You just came out of the nut house.
It was not a nut house.
Look, they drummed you right out of Hollywood. So you come crawling back to Broadway. Well, Broadway doesn't go for booze and dope.
You take that back.
Get your hand off.
Watching from the sidelines, blonde and beautiful Jennifer, the luminous Sharon Tate, follows Neely's path to Hollywood. But things don't come quite as easily to her. There's no denying her beauty, but it doesn't seem to be the kind that men appreciate. Jennifer seems to occupy an almost vacant place for the men around her, and her presence often comes with the assumption that she's at their service. While other women are finding their voices, she finds herself pushed into a career in so-called French titillation films, or as some might call it, porn.
Mademoiselle Pollard, have you seen your photography? I am interested in a young lady with your
measurements.
In general, the French girl is inclined to be flat in the bosom.
I see. Just what kind of pictures do you make, Mr. Chardin?
I make the art film.
Yes, I've seen a few. They're pretty raw. I mean, French subtitles over a bare bottom doesn't necessarily make it art.
Evil is only in the eye of the beholder, mademoiselle.
Meanwhile, Neely's career skyrockets and a haze of fame and pills quickly fogs her vision. Author Jacqueline Suzanne was herself once a struggling Hollywood hopeful and based many of the characters in her book on people she'd worked with. In fact, the film has so many odd backstories, it's hard to keep track. The beautiful blonde Jennifer North was said to be based on the real-life actress Carol Landis, who was once a rising film star but sadly ended her life after the collapse of a rocky affair with the actor Rex Harrison. And of course, Sharon Tate, the actress portraying Jennifer, would herself meet a horrific end at the hands of Charles Manson's infamous cult. Neely O'Hara, who begins the film as an innocent young starlet but quickly transforms into a Hollywood demon at the hands of pills and drinking, is said to be based upon the story of Judy Garland. Strangely, Garland herself was actually cast in the role that eventually went to Susan Heywood, after Garland ironically turned up to work drunk. She got her revenge on the producers, however, by refusing to hand back her costume and instead wearing it out on tour. In his 1967 review, Roger Ebert pulled no punches, savaging the film, writing that Hollywood was capable of the most offensive and appalling vulgarity ever thrown up by any civilization. 3 years later, Ebert himself would pen the screenplay for the at-first sequel, but later revised parody Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, which itself is an offensively unfunny and basically awful migraine of a movie that makes the original look like Gone with the Wind. There are dozens of films about Hollywood that are far, far superior to this one, but for sheer clueless melodrama and hilarious emotional manipulation smothered in crass, soapy silliness, Valley of the Dolls remains an essential film.
We're talking to Miss Sharon Tate, and we're aboard the Princess Italia after the premiere of Valley of the Dolls. And may we offer our congratulations. I guess this is your first major dramatic role.
If Valley of the Dolls had been the enormous success that many had anticipated, it might have been Sharon Tate's big break. She was romantically involved with director Roman Polanski, and the pair had achieved the kind of celebrity status reserved only for all-star couples. Like her character in the film, however, much of the interest in Sharon Tate tended to go back to the revealing nature of her scenes.
Well, I don't think there's any mood. I think if you try to prepare yourself, you fall flat on your face.
Face?
Yeah. Actually, it's very good, you know, because it's something so difficult to do. And I found that if you forget more what you're doing, you know, and try not to be so self-conscious about things that are so normal, people don't notice you as much as if you're, you know, trying to be so shy about everything.
On the 9th of August 1969, Sharon Tate was brutally murdered in the Los Angeles home that she and Roman Polanski rented together. Much has been written about her killers and the cult led by Charles Manson. But few details have been recorded about who Sharon Tate really was. That's at least partly because she was a genuinely private person. She was once quoted saying,
"Leslie Caron invited me to a party and I was thinking, what can I say to people that would be interesting?"
As the 1960s drew to a close, the feeling of a new generation taking charge had already taken hold. But it was the death of Sharon Tate that put a sudden, violent end to the countercultural dream of free love.
"I'd like to buy the world a home and furnish it with love, grow apple trees."
As the author Joan Didion wrote,
"Many people I know in Los Angeles believe that the 60s ended abruptly on August 9, 1969, ended at the exact moment when word of the murders on Cielo Drive traveled like brush fire through the community. And in a sense, this is true. The tension broke that day. The paranoia was fulfilled.
Late last year, American television schedules were clogged with all manner of specials, marking 20 years on from the still unsolved murder of JonBenet Ramsey. CBS aired a 6-hour documentary series. Dateline interviewed the 911 operator who took the original call from JonBenet's mother. Lifetime even aired its own dramatization of the case. Spoiler alert, it wasn't very good. Filmmaker Kitty Green, however, has taken on an entirely different approach. Her documentary, Casting JonBenet, cleverly switches the focus onto some of the inquisitive folk who have followed the case via the long, frenzied media coverage as they audition to play members of the Ramsey family. Tara Judah spoke to Kitty Green during the Berlin Film Festival.
JonBenet Ramsey, the name conjures memories of a little girl's life cut hideously short. Her parents and her brother, the chief suspects in a murder case that dragged on for years.
We held open casting calls across Boulder, Colorado, which is the town where JonBenet Ramsey was born and died. We invited the community, like actors, just regular people, to come in and just talk about, in addition to play a role in the film, but also talk about their own kind of connection to the case. It's more about kind of the legacy and mythology of JonBenet Ramsey than it is like a whodunit. So it's more about the way, the cultural obsession with this case and the way we can't let it go. So we're interested in people's personal kind of narratives. So the way that people come up with their own kind of stories in order to deal with something that essentially they can't make sense of.
It's an amazing approach because we see really personal stories from the actors and actresses. They start to talk about how it made them feel, how it affected, you know, the media coverage has affected their lives, how their personal stories are woven into it. How much did you try to elicit their personal stories and how much did they just offer that to you?
We're very honest about how we were going to use the material, and we said, listen, this casting material will be in the film and it's all part of it. And I was shocked by how honest everyone was with us. And maybe it's an American thing. I'm Australian, so for me it was odd how honest they were, but they would just sit down and just tell me everything about their lives. And it was really an incredible process. It was cathartic for me to sit through. And we felt very kind of honored that they would share that stuff with us. I mean, in some senses, our aim was to kind of humanize this story, which has been in the tabloids forever, but it's all facts and DNA. And unfortunately, there's a girl who's lost her life at the center of all this, and that often gets forgotten. So it was lovely to kind of make it human again and reconnect it to people's own pain and suffering and grief. And that was the intention.
Let me give the motive that is ascribed to you. You were downstairs, maybe she came down, she said, "Mommy, I wet my bed." You said, "Again, JonBenet," and you either pushed her or you hit her. You were exhausted, you were furious. You did it.
I like, too, that you didn't focus too much on fetishizing the JonBenet character, because it could have been about just casting her, or, you know, there could have been a lot of attention played to the kind of physicality of her. I mean, the pictures of her that have come up in the media time and time again, they're always those pageant photos. And I liked that we focused quite a lot more in your film on the stories around that, on the family, on the different characters. How did you feel about some sensitivity in the treatment of it being such a young girl?
We made a choice not to use any archival material, so any footage of the actual family in the film. And so instead, we kind of one step removed, and we're kind of analyzing more the community that lived around the tragedy's responses to it than the actual case itself. So I was very aware that I did not want to exploit this girl anymore. So she's in there and she makes appearances, obviously, but it's that idea that you kind of, she comes back just when you've forgotten what it's all about, and then you're reminded, oh gosh, yeah, it's this little girl. So that was sort of her purpose. She's sort of this spirit that floats above the story in some ways. And it becomes more about the nuclear family, about mothers and daughters and fathers and sons, and kind of these relationships that we can all relate to. I think that's why we're so obsessed with this case, is we can all kind of connect to it in some way.
When people appear in, you know, the kind of police station or the jail cell or the family home or the young boy's bedroom, these sets really give us a sense of credibility or lack of credibility for the things that the characters are saying. And the constructedness of the sets reminded me very much of Errol Morris's Thin Blue Line. It reminded me, I mean, also other recent films, Kate Plays Christine, but also your previous film, Ukraine Is Not a Brothel. This idea of the kind of constructedness that goes into documentary filmmaking.
He was just 9 when his little sister was found viciously strangled in the basement of their own home. The child beauty queen, eternally 6 years old.
The next thing I remember, my dad came and told me, JonBenet is in heaven now, and he started crying.
The whole film is about kind of the very nature of documentary, and about performance, and about truth, and about fiction, and about storytelling, and it's all kind of woven throughout the narrative, really. But we were very intentional with the sets, in that we wanted every set, you can kind of see the edges of all the sets. You can see ladders, you can see crew people, you can see, it's sort of intentionally artificial. So you always know that you're on a set, but you're not, it's not real, and it's not finished, and it's not complete. And so there was something about showing the kind of the making of this film, and a film that isn't ever going to be a film, but is almost a film, but never really, it sort of circles around itself in a lot of ways. And I think that to us was important, because there's no way we can finish it. We don't know who killed that girl. We will never know.
Director Kitty Green speaking to Tara Judah. Casting JonBenet is available right now on Netflix. The full edition of that interview was featured on our Berlin Film Festival special program. Head back to episode number 63.
I'd like to buy the world a home and furnish it with love.
That's all for today's show. Next week, we'll sit down with the legendary French filmmaker François Ozon, ahead of the release of his new film, France. The Cinema Show was edited by George McDonough and researched by Yulin Goffin. I'm Ben Rylan. We'll catch you next week.
And keep it coming.